This evening we are delighted to welcome our special guest speaker, Bishop Mark Davis. Bishop Mark was born in Manchester and went to study at university at Durham. He then studied for the priesthood at Ushaw College, during which time he regularly attended the Faith Summer Session. He was ordained in 1984, and in 2009 the Holy Father appointed him the Bishop of Shrewsbury. Bishop Mark has always been a great supporter of the faith movement, and we are extremely grateful that he is here with us this evening. The title of his talk is The Generation of August 1914 and the Generation of August 2014. Bishop Mark.
It's very, very good to be with you, and I feel that I've already made the best contribution to this Faith Summer Session. Father Jonathan and I have prayed very much for you as we've travelled down, and I've offered Mass for you. I just hope the words, the reflection which I'm sharing with you this afternoon might be of some encouragement, inspiration, and possibly challenge. It seems appropriate in this week to reflect on the challenges faced by a generation before us in the August of 1914 and the challenges we now face as the generation of August 2014. And first, we must know the time we are living in. My father, who's been seriously ill in hospital, has a much diminished sense of where he is from hour to hour. And I notice that he often asks, "What time is it?" He seems comforted simply to know that it's 2:15 or 7:30 or 5 o'clock, by which he situates himself in the time of day. And I notice that young children do something very similar when I visit schools. They ask, "How old are you?" They normally estimate I'm about 80, but to a young child, 25 or 85 are fairly close, particularly when you're 5 3/4. And it was interesting that as this summer session began on Monday evening, the nation was anxious to locate itself in time, exactly 100 years from the declaration of war, with the vigil in Westminster Abbey and the switching out of lights at 11 o'clock in the night. It was Saint John Paul II, the Pope chosen to lead us into the third Christian millennium, who so often reminded us of time. "In Christianity," he wrote, "time has a fundamental importance. With Christ coming in the fullness of time, the last days begin, the time of the church, leading to the glorious return of the Son of God at the end of time." So we see our time in the light of the incarnation and in expectation of Christ's final return. This is the time we are in. And this is how a Christian must always keep the time. However, there is a great danger of disorientation. The loss of the Christian memory, St. John Paul observed, is accompanied by a kind of fear of the future, of what is to come. And I've seen this in the response to the survey on the crisis of marriage and the family, which you've been looking at this week. This was the survey in preparation for the Extraordinary Synod in October, when the respondents have said to me that the church needs to catch up with the times. From this, perspective, which urges the Church to often abandon her teachings which conflict with lifestyles and moral outlooks in Western societies, it is never clear where this tide of time is ultimately leading us. Not, I fear, towards the kingdom of heaven. The biographer of St. John Paul II, George Weigel, notes an endearing and telling detail of the latter years of his life, that as an old man, he always wanted to get up early in the morning to watch the sun rising, the light of dawn, of a new day beginning. A man, the great saint of our time, who foresaw the dangers, also, and above all, saw the hope and the possibilities of time, the dawning of every new day which God gives to us. And we'll return to the great John Paul II and the sense of time he wants to share with us, but not without noting how Pope Benedict, his successor, in the great legacy of teaching he leaves to the Church, traced how the confusions and currents of contemporary thought have shaped so much of the tragedy of our own times. During the past century, he observed on the eve of his election as Pope, our dominion over matter grew by truly unthinkable measures. The growth of our possibilities, what we're capable of doing, has not been matched, Pope Benedict observed, by a comparable development of our moral energies. And this is what Father Holloway saw in what he compared in the late 20th century with the breakdown of the Roman civilization of antiquity. In our times, through the moral chaos of wars and rumors of wars and all the anguish of a dying civilization, he wrote, these new raw energies must be synthesized anew in a new unity of knowledge, both human and divine, if the meaning, dignity, and final goal of human life are not to be lost. The stakes are as high as this in the 21st century. Our Holy Father, Pope Francis, sees this drama in supernatural terms. In his daily preaching, he often returns to the perspective of chapter 6 of St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, which would reward your prayerful reading, that it is not against human enemies we have to struggle, St. Paul writes, but against the sovereignties and the powers who originate the darkness of this world, the spiritual army of evil in the heavens. In this spiritual conflict, which Pope Francis so often refers to, we see, we glimpse what underlies the currents of history and the seeming quiet of British society in the early 21st century. We are urged again in the Apostles' words to stand our ground armed with spiritual weapons. To many, history, the times in which we are living, can be as incomprehensible as the movements of the M25. A succession of events, 60, 50, 40, stop, start, why, we do not know. So in reflecting today on the challenge faced by the generation of August 1914, and now faced by ourselves, I want to share an even more mundane example of my own short-lived career as a burglar, which wasn't included in the biography. Looking through an address a couple of years ago in a block of retirement flats, I was met by a distressed elderly lady who told me that she just locked herself out of her ground floor flat and it was raining. And she asked, could I just climb in through the back window and release the door? What would you have done? Probably what I did, freeing the catch and clambering very awkwardly through the window. And then I was suddenly conscious that the elderly lady was gone. And the terrible thought struck me, is this really her flat? How would I explain to the Cheshire police why the Bishop of Shrewsbury was breaking in through the back window of an elderly person's property? It would be difficult to explain. Fortunately, the elderly lady was waiting at the front door, and no police investigation was necessary. Likewise, you'll have noticed, historians find it hard to account for why the Christian nations of Europe 100 years ago this week dragged the whole of the world down in violence and destruction on a scale which had never been seen before. One of our most distinguished historians, Sir John Keegan, quite simply concluded that the immense human tragedy of the Great War remains a mystery. And this might be some consolation for anyone who's had to write that essay on the causes of the First World War. It's a mystery. However, Keegan goes on to note, if only there had been some prudence, some wisdom, some goodwill, the whole tragedy of the century ahead might have been averted. Sadly, little wisdom, little goodwill was found in the summer of 1914. The statistics of this First World War vary considerably in their estimates, but always defy imagination. When we contemplate the sheer scale of this tragedy, some 20 million soldiers and civilians facing violent deaths, 21 million physically injured, and an incalculable number emotionally wounded. The generation who survived the war declared, never again, but this first global war would become the cause of a second war, even more destructive, with the loss of more than 50 million lives, and followed by a Cold War, which threatened all humanity with nuclear destruction. Historians have variously likened this crisis to an unexpected storm, to an airliner suddenly falling from the sky. However, the Pope of August 1914, Saint Pius X, did foresee the approaching tragedy. He foresaw how Europe, at one of the peaks of its human achievement, was about to turn its technological advances upon itself in an act of suicide. He pointed to Europe's apostasy in its intellectual, social, and moral life as pushing its peoples and entire societies inexorably towards destruction. The words of anguish with which Pope Pius X sometimes spoke in this period are at times almost too heartrending to repeat. As early as 1906, the Pope was describing the coming war to newly appointed bishops in France. By 1912, Pope Pius would speak frequently of a great war approaching. In his last appeal for peace on the 2nd of August, 2 weeks before his own death, the Pope spoke to the world of a disastrous war. He declared, as crowds cheered the declarations of war across Europe. No one can envisage the perils. No one can envisage the carnage. No one can envisage the consequences without overwhelming grief and fear. Asked by the warring parties for his blessing this week, 100 years ago, his response was equally emphatic. I will not bless war. I will bless peace. On his election as Pope in 1903, he'd set out an urgent purpose to restore all things in Christ. It was this he set out to invite all peoples to place Christ at the centre and summit of all life, to rest everything on his message. This, he said, must be the aim of every Christian in the new 20th century. And this is the context in which I want to remind you today of surely the greatest liturgical change of the past century, which has touched every one of our lives. A change which drew on the church's tradition, had been emphasized by the Council of Trent, but would astonish the Catholic world at the beginning of the 20th century when it was decreed without compromise, 5 days before Christmas in 1906. This same Pope Pius X, already foreseeing the tragic drama ahead, would propose to all the faithful frequent and even daily Holy Communion. Now, I've read how professors in our seminaries simply couldn't believe this, that all the faithful were being encouraged by the Pope to receive Holy Communion weekly or even daily. Church law to this day requires every member of the church to receive Holy Communion once a year, our Easter duty. And for centuries, this minimum requirement had been the practice of most members of the church. Holy Communion being received after definite preparation once or twice in the year. Generations before us were so concerned to receive, not to receive, the Holy Eucharist unworthily. They took very seriously the words of St. Paul to the Corinthians, whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of profaning the body and blood of the Lord. And these words of the apostle were not meant to be a deterrent from receiving the Eucharist, but an appeal to do so with the right disposition, to be ready to receive the Eucharist. Let a man examine himself, St. Paul continued, and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment upon himself. Before so great a sacrament, our catechism tells us, which contains the whole spiritual good of the church, Christ himself, the faithful can only echo humbly and with ardent faith the words of the centurion, Lord, I am not worthy, only say the word, and my soul shall be healed. We see in the reception of Holy Communion a call to holiness of life. Saint John Vianney had encouraged frequent Holy Communion amongst his parishioners against the pastoral practice of his time. However, even the great cure of Ars reflected at the end of his life that his preaching of monthly or weekly Holy Communion had not been entirely successful. I have done all I could, he said, to induce the men to communicate 4 times a year. Had they listened to me, they would already be saints. He was convinced what he called good communions, the Eucharist received with the right disposition with readiness of heart would especially enable the wavering men of his parish to persevere in the Christian life and advance to the heights of holiness. Now, I have little doubt that St. John Vianney's pastoral vision was also the inspiration of this dramatic decree of 1906. The statue of the cure of Ars, St. John Vianney, stood on the desk of St. Pius X throughout his pontificate. The cure of Ars in his tiny parish, following the turmoil of the French Revolution, had faced the challenges which Europe would face more widely. And from this tiny parish, he set in motion what we might call a new evangelization of Europe and of France. Pope Pius X, we can be sure, was not concerned with recovering antiquated liturgical practice, but together with John Vianney, the saint of the new evangelization, was concerned that all of the faithful would be prepared for the enormous challenges ahead of them. And this, I believe, underlies the decree on frequent Holy Communion. Holy Communion is the shortest and surest way to heaven, St. Pius X famously reflected. And the decree of Christmas 1906 read, "In these days, when religion and the Catholic faith are attacked on all sides, it is doubly necessary that the faithful should be strengthened and the love of God kindled in their hearts by this saving practice of frequent Holy Communion." 4 years later, Pope Pius X would decree young children from the age of reason, when they were able to distinguish the Holy Eucharist from ordinary bread, could be admitted to Holy Communion. It is why most of us received our first Holy Communion around the age of 7, rather than from the age of 12 upwards. Again, the goal was holiness, for children to attain sanctity from their youngest years. Pope Pius wanted the faithful to be clear that the reception of the Eucharist was not a reward for attaining personal holiness, but was the means of truly becoming holy, the saint that we are each called to be. And it was due to this initiative that a countless number would be ready to receive Holy Communion in the mud and dust of the wars which marked the century ahead, and with a readiness and a disposition to receive Christ himself. It was not as a comforting ritual that Holy Communion was distributed in the trenches of the Great War, or even in the concentration camps of the Second, but as the means for each to reach the goal of holiness. Sherry Waddell, in her book Forming Intentional Disciples, recently commended by Bishop Egan in the pages of Faith magazine, draws on the Second Vatican Council's description of the Eucharist as the summit of the Christian life. And she does know something about summits, living in Colorado, beside a summit of some 14,000 feet. She writes, "Just as we have to climb a mountain summit, we have to make an intentional journey, properly prepared to fully receive the inexhaustible grace to be found in the Eucharistic Christ." Theologians had long debated what constituted this right intention, this preparedness to receive Holy Communion. Pope Pius clarified for all times to come that it was simply this: to please God, to be more united with God in charity, to seek divine remedy for our defects and weaknesses, and though freedom from venial sin is always to be desired, it is sufficient that a communicant be free from mortal sin and have a firm purpose of avoiding sin in the future. Those are the dispositions with which we must always come to Holy Communion. And this, of course, represents a whole program for personal holiness. And we can quickly see why in the mind of the curé of Ars, the evasion by some men of his parish of frequent Holy Communion was an evasion of their own call to holiness. In St. John Vianney's words, they would already have been saints. And in the present debates surrounding admission to Holy Communion, we must never lose sight of this call to holiness, to Christian perfection, of which the Holy Eucharist offers to those ready to receive this gift the shortest and the surest route. Now, we've reflected together on how the 20th century began, and I want to turn our thoughts now to how this new century has begun for us, for the generation of 2014. We cannot, of course, foresee what lies ahead in an increasingly volatile and dangerous world, a world equally menaced by destructive ideologies. And we certainly live on a continent in a quiet and not always so quiet state of apostasy, now in danger of even losing its Christian foundations, losing sight of its Saviour. A new generation, St. John Paul II said at World Youth Day in the year 2000, are now being called to be the morning watchmen of this new millennium. It's a biblical image which St. Gregory the Great explained in his rule as a watchman standing on the height so that he can see from afar what is coming, what is approaching. Anyone appointed to be such a watchman for the people must stand on a height for all of his life to help them by his foresight. This great saint of our own lifetime, St. John Paul II, recognized this as a decisive moment for humanity, a threshold of hope, as he called it, if we are ready to choose the path of hope. His biographer notes that if history grants to him the title the Great, it will be for no other reason that at a moment of peril, parallel to the times of Pope Gregory the Great, Pope Leo the Great, when barbarisms threatened civilization, a heroic figure was called from the church to meet barbarism and to propose an alternative. Now, I remember vividly that bright autumn day in 1978 when the voice of a young pope sounded across St. Peter's Square and across the world, "Be not afraid to welcome Christ and his power. Open wide the doors for Christ." St. John Paul certainly foresaw a new springtime of the Christian life, following the winter of what he often described as the century of tears, the 20th century. He foresaw this new springtime, but he realized it was something which must be consciously chosen by new generations, as this century could also become a new age of barbarism. And this is the choice he saw as being in your hands, within your hearts, and is why he invited through World Youth Day new generations to take up the cross of Christ and to carry it in their hearts and in their hands along all the pathways of the earth. And in this gathering today, I can glimpse how along all the pathways of this new century, You will each be needed, as married people and parents, as priests and religious, in all the fields of medicine and science and education, of finance, law and politics, and every field of human endeavour. However, we must take note of the warning of a Catholic convert and social activist, Dorothy Day, who said, "The times in which we are living will no longer allow anyone to be mediocre. It is no longer possible for anyone to be a mediocre Christian." And Pope John Paul II made this clear at the dawn of the new millennium, when he wrote that all of the church's pastoral initiatives must be set in relation to nothing less than holiness. "The time has come," he said, "to re-propose to everyone this high standard of ordinary Christian living." And this, of course, echoed what the Second Vatican Council had taught, that all the Christian faithful are called to the fullness of the Christian life and to the perfection of charity wherever they are in life, and without any exception. Another saint of the 20th century, Saint Jose Maria, would refer to these crises being always crises of saints. He didn't specify exactly what the crises were, but the 20th century knew no shortage, and he himself had lived through the horror of the Spanish Civil War. However, the crises of the world, and indeed of the church, require men and women who would be willing and ready to rise towards this great goal of holiness in every walk of life. And the 40 years of the faith movement give clear witness to this. In seeking to live by the faith of the church, as generations of young people have done amid all the crises of our times, we reflect on Father Holloway's words that the world is never so poor, never so much in trouble in its self-caused crises, as when there is a dearth of saints to love it without cause, redeem it with blood, reclaim it with sweat and tears, no matter what this venture costs. At World Youth Day in the year 2000, St. John Paul II famously echoed, in paraphrase, the word of another saint to the 2 million young people who'd come to Rome. "If you are what you should be, you will set the world on fire." But that invitation is often just left there. He actually pointed us to how this world will be transformed, its crises resolved, how we will be on fire and how we will remain on fire. And it shouldn't surprise us that he pointed, like his saintly predecessor almost a century before, to the Holy Eucharist. "Dear friends," he said, "to those to whom this new century and its challenges belong, when you go back home, set the Eucharist at the centre of your personal life and community life. Love the Eucharist, adore the Eucharist, and celebrate it, especially on Sundays. I entrust to you, dear friends, this greatest of God's gifts to us who are pilgrims on the pathways of time, but who bear in our hearts a thirst for eternity. So we journey in our time into the times before us, not alone, but with this great gift of the Eucharist, and in the light of the Eucharist, the real presence of Jesus Christ, who is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Amen.